Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Brady Carlson in for Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, a writing professor turned one-time war correspondent reports from the battlefield, a reenactment of the French and Indian War. Plus, technology's missing links, why the failed preambles and prototypes of our most beloved gadgets helped shape the tech industry's greatest achievements. But first, tales of moral courage in trying circumstances. In the midst of horrific atrocities like the Holocaust and the ethnic cleansing that took place in the Balkans in the 1990s, there are tales of individuals who fly in the face of convention or even the law to stand up for what they know is right. IL Press is the author of the new book Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. The book fleshes out stories of stunning bravery and digs into the why of acts that seem improbable, sometimes even impossible in their contexts. Ayal, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me on.
When we talk about the courage of the people in this book, it seems like a very specific kind of courage, certainly different from, say, someone who's, you know, climbing Mount Everest or something like that. What is it that drives a beautiful soul?
Well, it is a very specific kind of courage, and it is really moral courage. It is a courage that you very rarely, particularly from your neighbors, your coworkers, your own government, your society, get thanked for. At least that's what I discovered in reporting these stories. We can think about the different kind of courage if we think about two, say, different kinds of soldiers. A soldier in Iraq who fought in a battle has a great deal of physical courage, and I don't in any way mean to discount that physical courage, but then we can compare the physical courage of, say, climbing a mountain or going into battle with the courage of Joseph Darby, a reservist in Iraq, who had a crisis of conscience and ended up handing a CD full of incriminating photos to the Army's Criminal Investigation Division in 2004. Those photos were the photos of the abuses in Abu Ghraib. And Darby, like so many of the characters in my book, as I say, was not thanked for this. He was called a traitor. And when he returned to his hometown, he received a string of death threats that actually prompted him eventually to move. And so I really look in the book at people who, because of their principles, because of what they believed, were willing to really go against the grain.
The title of the book, Beautiful Souls. Now, in Israel, that often means someone who's kind of naive. How does that fit with the people in this book? You wouldn't think the word naive would leap to mind with moral courage.
No, you wouldn't. But I chose the title in part because I think it captures rightly the ambivalence, sometimes even the hostility and the judgment that people often do feel for those who are too firm in their principles, who are maybe too pure, or as you say, bleeding hearts. In Israel, of course, this is a country that has had war after war and has plenty of very real threats, and young people are understandably raised with a sense that they have an obligation to serve in the army. When they feel a moral dilemma about that, then they risk being seen as beautiful souls, as these bleeding hearts, as people who are too pure. And one character in the book indeed goes through this struggle of fearing that he is being seen this way and eventually decides he will not serve in the occupied territories.
Let's talk about another one of the stories in the book, which it's where it starts, really, in Switzerland. In 1938, that country closes its borders to Jewish refugees fleeing Austria and Hitler. One police captain, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, Paul Gerninger, disobeys the order and helps several thousand Jews cross the border. He literally saved their lives. This is not a guy known for rocking the boat. Why did he, of all people, step up in this situation?
You did pronounce his name rightly, Gruninger, and he's really a remarkable character. And I opened the book with him because I think he's in some ways very exemplary of the kinds of people who do these things. As you say, he was not a radical. He was not a rebel. He did not seem like someone willing to rock the boat or prone to doing so. But from the perspective of the Swiss authorities, Gruninger made one very crucial mistake. Here he was serving on the border with Austria, and instead of delegating the task of turning Jewish refugees to someone else, he met with them directly. He let them come to his headquarters. He saw them, and he saw the desperation that was driving them. And as he told his daughter, who I interview and describe in the book, after these encounters, these personal face-to-face encounters, he felt he couldn't do anything else. The other notable thing about Gruninger, which is, again, typical of many of the characters in the book, he was a very devout Swiss patriot. And you wouldn't think, well, okay, Swiss patriot, he must follow the law. He's a police captain. But he actually believed very deeply in the idea that Switzerland was a refuge for the persecuted. This is very much a part of Swiss national identity. It's what he was raised on. And so he thought, well, if I let these people in, I will be forgiven for doing so. People will understand because, after all, it's the right thing to do. He was not forgiven, as people who read the book will find out.
I wanted to come back to the first point you said about how Grüninger personally heard these appeals and how unusual that was. And the other officials were insulating themselves. They used bureaucratic structures to avoid seeing those appeals from the Jewish families. It strikes me that there are so many instances today where people are getting further and further removed from direct involvement with each other. The one that came to mind first for me was the increase in military drone strikes. But on a lower level, I mean, just getting through to a person for customer service is getting harder. Do those kinds of structures mean there are going to be fewer Paul Grüningers in our future?
Well, that absolutely is something we should be discussing and thinking about and talking about, because, as you say, the layers of bureaucracy, of maybe technology and other things that remove us from these face-to-face encounters can have very destructive consequences. And indeed, much of some of the people who write about the Holocaust point out, and I think that horror, that horrible, horrible genocide made people think, well, how can people do such things? And we started having a literature about, you know, the diffusion of responsibility and the fact that too often the people at the bottom who were delegated the terrible tasks to perform, they could say to themselves, well, it's not me that formulated the policy, it's someone above me that did so. And then, of course, the person above them doesn't do it directly. So everyone, in a sense, is insulated. And the really difficult thing is to say, no, I will assert my moral responsibility here.
We're talking with IL Press. He's the author of a new book about what compels ordinary people to act against the grain in nearly impossible situations. It's called Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. There's this romantic vision of the defiant hero throughout American culture. You know, you think back to Henry David Thoreau and the idea of civil disobedience, or Rosa Parks, you know, refusing to stand up and move her seat on the bus. There's a quote in the book that asks a tough question, though. It says, "What is to stop the principled defiance of a good man from being emulated by a dangerous fanatic?"
Yeah. That quote comes up in a chapter where I discuss one of the sort of classic critiques of acts of conscience, is that they are inherently subjective, some feel. That is that, you know, one person will defy an order for one reason that we may admire. Another person may defy an order for a reason we don't admire. If we think of the civil rights movement, we had people who were defying the law to integrate lunch counters. We also had people who were defying the law to terrorize African Americans. And so we do, I think, in the end, have to judge these acts by their moral content. It's not resistance alone is not something that we always admire. I do think, though, that in general, as a society, we benefit from the nonconformists and from the people among us who are willing to not just state their principles, but live them out when thrust into these moral dilemmas.
Who are the nonconformists today, then? Who are the beautiful souls that their stories are maybe still unfolding, but that we should keep an eye on them?
Well, the book actually ends. The book is structured so that we begin with World War II, with the story of Paul Grüninger in 1938. And in a sense, it's very familiar. We know these stories of the few heroes, they're often called the righteous, who helped and assisted Jews. But it ends with the story of a financial industry whistleblower named Leila Weidler. And I included that story in the book because I feel that, not unlike Paul Grüninger, Leila Weidler was in a situation where she had a choice. It was a somewhat less stark choice. She didn't have desperate refugees coming to her. She was told to sell a financial instrument that she had doubts about. And she was a broker with a very high-paying job and a nice office and so forth. Should she do it or shouldn't she do it? The people around her did do it. Leila asked questions. You know, she asked questions of her boss. How safe is this? Why are the returns so high? It turns out that the firm she worked at was the Stanford Financial Group, which perpetrated the second largest Ponzi scheme in U.S. history. And Leila, who was fired from her job, warned the SEC and tried to raise concerns about this Ponzi scheme in 2003. 5.5 years later, the rest of the country learned that all of these investors had lost their money because too few people spoke out.
Lastly, you write about a poll that said a huge majority of people said, yeah, I would be a whistleblower if I was in one of these situations. I would be like Leila or Paul Grüninger. And then you look at the actual situations and a lot of that doesn't materialize. Why is it that so many people think of themselves as whistleblowers and then aren't?
I think one simple thing is fear. We are social animals. We like to fit in. We too often find, as we talked about, reasons to disavow responsibility for the situations we're in, even when we know we're doing something that we're not going to be proud of or that is wrong. But the second reason, I think, and this is one of the points of the book, is that we also too often, you know, sometimes we imagine it's so easy. Of course I would be one of these resistors. But the other thing we do is we imagine that the only people who resist are, you know, saints or superheroes or perfect people, people with no flaws. And I wrote the book to show and in a sense to argue against that position, because if we imagine only saints can do these things, then in a sense we relieve ourselves of having to even try to emulate their examples. I mean, after all, who among us is a saint? Most of us are flawed. But in the book, you get stories of disarmingly ordinary people who do extraordinary things.
Eyal, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Eyal Press is a contributor to The Nation, the New York Review of Books, and a fellow at the New America Foundation. For more on his book, Beautiful Souls, go to wordofmouthradio.org, and we'd love to hear what you think. Do you want to believe you'd blow the whistle, even if it meant your life would change forever? Join the conversation taking place on our Facebook page or send us a tweet. Coming up, live from New York, it's a comic book. The world's most famous Saturday night comedy show gets the graphic novel treatment. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a break. This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Brady Carlson.
And live from New York, it's Saturday Night!
Saturday Night Live. You may love it, you may love to hate it, you may even hate to admit you love it. Either way, the 35-year-old comedy institution is now turning into a comedy illustration, thanks to Chad Lambert and his team. Chad is a comic artist and author, and he's editor of the new series Comics from Blue Water Productions, a series of biographies about comedians. The first installment in the series is about the history of Saturday Night Live. Chad Lambert joins us now to tell us more. Chad, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks.
10 years ago, TV critic Tom Shales wrote the oral history of SNL called Live from New York, and it took him 566 pages to tell the whole story. You've got, what, 24? How the heck did you fit all of that in?
That's the magic question. How do you get from Gilda to Gil Lee in 24 pages? And it really comes down to, it came from the person who was there, and it's told through the eyes of Lorne Michaels and how he's adapted to the changing times to keep this show fresh and relevant over four very different decades.
One of the lines that he says as the narrator in the book I thought was really revealing. He said, "I didn't get the humor, but young people did, and that was what mattered."
Yeah, I mean, he had a real respect for the process that funny people have. And he respects it, and he understands it, and he trusts their judgment. And that's very obvious as the show evolved, especially into the 90s when the tone of the show kind of changed and was a little more subversive and slapstick than it was known for.
But I guess in that way, he's really like anybody else. I mean, we each have sort of our own period, our own cast that we prefer. And the history of the show sort of becomes classic argument fodder no matter who's in the room.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, I approached it from the three universal truths of Saturday Night Live. And that is that every person on the earth knows the show. Everyone has a favorite era. And everyone believes that it's never as good as it used to be.
I wanted to ask about translating this show to comic art. You think of some of the cast members who have been on the show, and they give off that aura of motion. You know, there's something happening around them at all times, even if they're not physically moving. Eddie Murphy's one, Belushi's another. I mean, comics have always suggested movement in still art, but is it different for an artist to show movement when your subject is not a superhero but is a not-ready-for-prime-time player? You can't just put a row of squiggle lines behind Eddie Murphy, can you?
No, you can't. And, you know, that's the challenge of writing non-superhero, is you have to be able to convey the message without the benefit of the performance. Nothing in the book is actually what occurs on the show. So, in other words, everything is behind the scenes. Everything is the build-up to the show. So you're seeing everything that you've never actually seen on the television show before. So that gave us some creative freedom to interpret things that have been written about the show, the oral history of the show, and being able to put those pieces together visually with the narrative of Lorne Michaels.
Speaking of superheroes, reading the book reminded me of a sketch from the early days of the show, a superhero party. Let's hear a little bit of that. It features John Belushi as the Incredible Hulk.
How was the parade? Were you the Grand Marshal again?
No, it's the Green Lantern's turn this year. We rotate. One way.
Oh, Cookie, Hulk, what happened to you?
What do you think happened? I swear, first thing Monday morning, twin beds.
Oh, we got a present for you.
What?
Kryptonite!
Has Saturday Night Live or any of the actors on the show ever figured into superhero comic books? Like, I'm thinking of the way Stephen Colbert got himself into an issue of Spider-Man.
Yeah, actually, a couple of the current cast members, Seth Meyers and Bill Hader, recently wrote an issue of Amazing Spider-Man. And, you know, Saturday Night Live, it's appeared in comics a few times before. It was in Marvel Team-Up in the 70s where Peter Parker and Mary Jane attended a live broadcast of the show, and the Coneheads were in the comics in the 90s. But there's always been a connection, I think, between the show and comic books, or the show is aware of comic books as a medium.
As I was preparing for our talk, I was thinking of a number of different parallels along those same lines, and one that struck me was, you know, Saturday Night Live has been declared dead over and over, and comics and the comic industry have been declared dead more than a few times, too. You're a fan of both. How do you see each holding up in 2012?
That is a good question. I think a lot of people consider comic books dead as a monthly pamphlet medium, as they call it. But, you know, I think they're both still extremely relevant. I don't get the Saturday Night Dead of 2012. I think the show's still extremely relevant. As long as it's relevant and as long as it's still doing what it's supposed to do, you can't really call it dead.
Your narrator, Lorne Michaels, says the show was web-friendly before there was a web to be friendly to. And so I think in that same way, comics and Saturday Night Live both have that web-friendly component, and that's given them kind of both a resurgence.
No, I mean, if you think about it, in 1975, the not-ready-for-primetime players were YouTube. I mean, everything was 3 and 4 minute segments. The show was just destined to explode on the internet. Comics is doing the same way now with tablet computers and on-demand services, that you're going to see a whole new interest in that medium over the next decade.
Here's another parallel that I saw. SNL has often found its cast members through improv and comedy communities, sometimes semi-underground communities. And in a way, the big comic houses have done the same thing. Some of the authors who used to write the underground comic lines 15, 20 years ago, they're now the big stars. And thinking of a Grant Morrison or an Aaron Magruder, they're now the big names in the industry.
Yeah, I mean, there's parallels. I think the entertainment industry, whether it's, you know, comic book writer, comedian, actor, it's all the same process. It's all getting your feet wet and doing things you like that you have a taste for. I mean, I'm the same way. I came out of underground, and I still consider writing Saturday Night Live to be extremely underground because of that attitude the show had, and you definitely see that in independent comics.
Just as I was reading your book, I also read about a comic series on political figures, and Mitt Romney is the focus of the new book. Is this just a new way for people to re-experience history and biography?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Blue Water, my publisher, that's their bread and butter. It's everything from political figures to, you know, current hot celebrities to even this series, Comics, which my friend James Reed formed, which was a series of biographies based on historical comedy and legends of comedy and their contributions to society. And that's where Saturday Night Live fits in as a comic book.
You said you're a lifelong fan of the show, and I understand that not long after you finished the script for the book, you finally got to see a live broadcast.
You know, I was offered this book in March, and I hadn't done biographies before, and was, you know, waffling back and forth of whether or not I wanted to, you know, commit to the research and do everything. So my family and I went on a Disney vacation, and on day three, I run into Tina Fey at Disney World. She was just hanging out with her family, and my kid was playing with her kid, and I didn't even realize it was her. So I took that as a sign that I should write it. And 6 months later, once I turned the script in, by total coincidence, my name came up in the NBC ticket lottery. So my wife and I flew to New York and got to sit in on a live broadcast this past October. So it was quite the overall experience.
Did it live up to the expectation?
It was glorious. It is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. I mean, to be sitting in the same stage that, you know, John Belushi performed the Blues Brothers and Eddie Murphy did the James Brown Celebrity Hot Tub Party, you feel that when you walk through that door of Studio 8H. It was totally amazing.
Chad, thanks so much for talking with us.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Well, let me give you some free advice, all right? You know, my old lady comes up to me and she says, you've been messing around. My old ladies come up to me and say, you've been messing around with some other women. I say, honey, you just take me as I am or you just let me be. That's right.
Chad Lambert is editor of the new series Comics from Blue Water Productions, which is releasing a comic book retelling the history of Saturday Night Live. You can find out more about the book and the series at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Buzzing around your hat. Well, I can make honey, baby. Well, let me come inside. Well, I'm a king.
Word of mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Brady Carlson, in for Virginia Prescott. If you're into tech, I'm sure you've heard the joke about Apple's iPad. Not since Moses has the world been this excited about a tablet. Truth be told, the iPad's now iconic features didn't drop from the sky into Steve Jobs' hands. If anything, tech development is a lot more like evolutionary biology, and if you look beneath our latest and greatest gadgets, you'll find evidence of that evolutionary process, including products that were born of good ideas but didn't quite make the cut. Think of them as the tech world's missing links, although that term, missing links, is itself sort of outmoded in biology circles. Okay, I'm getting a little too meta here, so let's just turn things over to our guest, Rob Fleischman. He's a computer scientist, tech entrepreneur, and Word of Mouth's explainer of all things Wired. Rob, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Brady. It's great to be here.
As I mentioned in the lead there, Steve Jobs seems to get all the credit for the tablet explosion, but the big iPad reveal a couple years ago wasn't exactly the first time this idea turned into hardware.
That's absolutely true. The concept of a tablet's been around a long time, and the technology has been spread through a number of devices. If you think about the Palm and its OS, remember its pen-based OS long ago? That had the concept of apps. And actually, Bill Gates at Microsoft introduced the tablet PC at Comdex in the year 2000. Now, there's been a number of tablets, and you know, let's admit that the iPad's really been a blowout success, and there are some reasons for that. The predecessors had all kinds of problems. For example, they came with handwriting recognition, but it was really bad, and it was slow. There was no networking, if there was networking, it was really slow and bad networking or complex networking. The tablets didn't have much storage. They had very low amounts of memory. They couldn't run very much. And when they did run applications, the processors were slow. You know, it was kind of like having a car that went 6 miles an hour. It just wasn't something you really wanted.
I want to play a little bit of that Microsoft presentation. It was uploaded to YouTube by an audience member who had, at that time, it was a really high-tech ability of capturing video on a still cam. This is actually not Bill Gates. It's a Microsoft engineer walking through a demonstration of that tablet.
I'm using Microsoft Visio on this device, and it's got a USB keyboard and mouse, and it's got audio and all. It's a full-fledged PC. In fact, I think it's got about 10 gigabytes of disk space. The entire system is built in right here, okay? So you can imagine this makes a great reading device. In fact, it's got Microsoft Reader installed on it. It's super for e-books.
An entire system built into a handheld device that's great for e-reading. Was this engineer by chance, Rob, wearing a black turtleneck when he was doing the product launch?
Worked for Microsoft. Probably not.
Yeah, I suppose not. But it is mentioned, interesting that he mentions e-books, because e-books didn't catch on really until a less sophisticated device, the Kindle, really put them in our hands. So does it take a gateway device like the Kindle to get us ready for something that's more powerful like a tablet?
Well, gateway devices are single-purpose things that really focus on one particular application, and the Kindle's, great form factor, great graphics, a lot of new technology specific to e-book reading, and it's wonderful. But there's something underlying, some old-school secret. There was a guy named Gordon Moore who coined something called Moore's Law. Moore's Law, very famous. So people don't really know who Gordon Moore was. He, in 1970, he was the co-founder of Intel. Now, Intel makes a tremendous number of chips. Mr. Moore is a billionaire and just incredible trailblazer in technology. And Moore's Law said that inexpensive transistor density doubles every 2 years. Now, in English, what that means, is that computing power and speed at a low cost doubles every 2 years. And when we talk about these early devices, you'll always hear about how, well, we just didn't have the power or the memory or the capacity or the network or the computing. And Moore's Law is what helped a lot of this. So I would claim that a lot of the successes we have today are because of Moore's Law. Why is the iPad great? Well, it's finally fast enough. Why does it have a camera? Well, we finally have the technology to make a camera that's small and cheap and dense and high quality and can take a picture quickly and put it in your tablet.
You mentioned speed, and another one of the big innovations that we've been hearing about recently is the super inexpensive Google Chromebook, and its claim to fame is the ultra-fast boot time. But again, we should say there was a predecessor even to this device.
Absolutely. I remember back in the day, Sun came out with something called the network computer. Now, it was a little different. Its idea was that you'd put all these network computers on the desktops of everybody in your large business. And the network computer, just like the Google Chromebook, didn't have much inside of it. In fact, it got its operating system, all of its data, everything right from the network. It was fast, memory-based, lightweight, and cheap. Very much, again, like the Chromebook. And this was back in 1997. Now, Sun was pushing it mostly at the enterprise, at businesses, to lower cost, make things maintainable, make it so you didn't have to go to everyone's desktop to upgrade the latest version of the word processor, etc. But the concept was exactly the same. Everything in, quote, the cloud. Of course, there wasn't a cloud back then, but, you know, everything in the cloud, everything from the network. Now, why didn't it work? Well, first of all, again, you know, it was a desktop machine, not portable. Sun's OS was Solaris, not exactly the most user-friendly thing at the time. Networking was slower, and the costs were high. And now I think we've gotten to the point where this Chromebook, you know, is appealing to a certain segment of people. I view competition between tablets and the Chromebook as an area for the next few years.
We're talking about technology's missing links, the devices that failed despite being somewhat similar to what we're using today. Our guest is our favorite tech explainer, Rob Fleischman. We've been talking about tablets. We've been talking about computers. Let's talk a little bit about smartphones. You know, Apple comes up, obviously, with the iPhone and Research in Motion, the maker of the BlackBerry. But there are some other innovators in the field that came even before them. We should give them a little shout out here, too.
Oh, my goodness. In the smartphone area, IBM was the king. In 1992, they came out with something called the Simon. And I'm not talking about the, you know, kids follow the flashing colors and sounds device. I'm talking about a real smartphone. I mean, I'm talking about something with a touch screen, keypad, internet connectivity, predictive text, games, calendars, contacts, email, calculators, notepads, sketchpads, to-do lists, you name it. This thing they called the personal communicator was really the world's first smartphone, and IBM and Bell South came together to build this thing, and it actually worked. And this was 92, 93. Now, again, why didn't that succeed? You know, the device had slow networking, you know, it was heavy, it was big, you know, cost $1,000 back in 1992.
That may have had something to do with it.
$1,000 in 1992 is a tremendous amount of money. So, you know, there was a lot of things that made the Simon really something that wasn't going to work for popular culture. But in terms of the technology, it was just staggering. I mean, the folks at IBM just hit it out of the park, totally thought out of the box, but way ahead of its time.
Has there ever been a case where one of these technologies, one of these innovations, has actually taken hold in the first iteration, or do they almost always wind up needing some time and some refinement?
I think that there's a standard life cycle of innovation, you know, from your early adopters. And you can read a book called Crossing the Chasm, where they talk about how new technology gets to the mass market. You know, I think that process repeats itself. Now, do some devices move quickly? Absolutely. Do companies blow up and become huge faster? I mean, has Facebook grown faster than Google? Absolutely. And it has to do with falling down that road. You know, as people get excited and comfortable about a piece of technology, it gets everywhere, you know, much faster. Look at GPS. I mean, GPS really has blown up everywhere. I mean, it's in all of our phones now. So I would say that all technology follows that same curve, and how fast they go up that curve, that certainly has gotten compressed and depends on how comfortable people are with the new technology.
Well, Rob, you just keep getting better every time you come on the show. So thanks for being with us again today.
My pleasure, Brady. Thanks for the kind words.
Rob Fleischman is Chief Technology Officer at ZeroCall, entrepreneur and word-of-mouth explainer of all things Wired. For some of the missing links we talked about, you can click over to our decidedly modern website, wordofmouthradio.org. You won't find too many people today using these missing link gadgets from years past, but look at the evolution of the internet and you'll find a slightly different story. Back in the day, web users communicated on platforms with funky, techie names like Usenet, IRC, and NNTP. Those systems do live on today. Producer Todd Bookman has this report now, with a guest appearance by Rob Fleischman, about a select few who are bypassing Facebook and Google Plus and going old school. They're using an online forum with no pop-up ads and animated banners, where there's no double-clicking, no need for a mouse, and no graphics.
Before Facebook, before Google, even before Al Gore, there was an internet. The 1980s internet, perhaps best portrayed in the movie War Games, starring Matthew Broderick.
Shall we play a game?
Oh.
I think I missed him.
Yeah, weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Love to. How about global thermonuclear war?
Wouldn't you prefer a good game of chess?
The story goes, Broderick takes his old-fashioned telephone, puts the handset on a cradle modem, and uses his computer to connect to a military supercomputer. They play tic-tac-toe, things go awry, global thermonuclear war almost breaks out. Sounds outdated, right? Obsolete? Turns out, not quite. Today, that version of the internet, of people communicating through simple lines of text and commands, is still very much alive. To see it in action, I went down into one user's basement, or technically speaking, his parents' basement.
And how do you pronounce your name?
Well, I always type it, so there's never really any need to pronounce it, but I guess Bullywiff, that's how you might say it. Yeah, that's it, I guess.
Bullywiff is this guy's handle, his screen name. The 23-year-old college student asked me to not reveal his identity. He's a member of an online community called SDF, which is sort of like Facebook, Gmail, Craigslist, and a gaming site all rolled into one. But there aren't videos or pictures or pop-ups, and most users remain anonymous.
This is a lot more elegant, I think. This is just text. There's no mouse. It's just all in a command line. Using a mouse and having windows and dragging stuff around it's distracting.
The screen is pretty boring to look at if you don't understand this stuff. Instead of websites, users are accessing a shared operating system. They can chat, email, and post within the system, but only by typing in commands. SDF has been around since 1987 and hasn't changed much since then. It currently has about 30,000 members, but at one time, this type of computing was the internet.
They were extremely popular. They were like the alternative to AOL and CompuServe back in the early days. But nowadays, they're, you know, very, very obscure.
Rob Fleischman is a computer scientist and internet architect. He says there is a very good reason why these shared systems faded away.
These little areas of the internet that are not particularly popular are great places for nefarious characters.
Porn, pirated software, and illegal file sharing took over this pre-web internet. Now, most of that business has migrated onto the mainstream web. But what hasn't changed about these systems is that users like Bullywiff want to remain anonymous. This stands in stark contrast to what is happening on the web. More than anything else, Facebook has dramatically altered how we share information online. Pictures, relationship status, schedules, everything is up for grabs. It's a world of oversharing. And even though we know companies are monitoring that data and selling it and using it to target ads, we seem to be all right with that. Rob Fleischman says that this new openness actually makes more sense than the alternative.
If I use a handle, am I going to be having conversations with people that I care about? It really depends on what I want. And there's a price to be gained by giving up your privacy. By giving up my privacy, I can connect with my old high school and college friends.
It should be said that, by and large, SDF users like Bullywiff are not engaging in seedy activities online. For them, this is a community. Back in the 80s, when users still had to use landline telephones to connect, they would usually only communicate with other computers that had a local number. Nobody wanted to pay long-distance charges. And because other users were in your area, it was common for them to get together in person. Online friends actually became real friends. Bullywiff told me that is still happening.
Yeah, actually, I've seen a couple posts, people saying, you know, all right, anyone in this area, let's meet up in this bar and hang out. And, you know, I think that would be really cool. I haven't come across anyone in Concord, New Hampshire. If I did, I'd love to meet up with them.
For now, Bullywiff is content meeting new friends online. While he showed me some of his favorite chat rooms and different old school games he plays on SDF, I asked him if this type of internet surfing is really only something a tech geek could love. I didn't mean to stereotype, but it just seemed to me like that term was a good way to, well, stereotype this whole thing.
The tech geek that's kind of become chic recently, like, I don't know, you see people in Wired magazine, there's like a specific style of clothing they wear, specific way they do their hair, and they identify themselves as tech geeks and write about the latest Apple gadgets and products. The people I've met with on SDF seem to just be computer literate people who are genuinely interested in this shared experience. You know, they might refer to themselves as tech geeks, or they might just refer to themselves as people. Probably most often they would just refer to themselves as people.
These aren't normal people, though. Remember, these are internet users that actually understand how the internet works. Rob Fleischman told me that this type of computing will always exist. There will always be users that are willing to trade the bells and whistles of a website for the hard elegance of code. But because it requires a level of knowledge that most users will never seek or obtain, it will likely stay limited to the basement. For Word of Mouth, I'm Todd Bookman.
Coming up, a journalist embedded in a war zone, sort of. A report from the safest kind of battle, the one fought by reenactors. This is Word of Mouth. I'm Brady Carlson, in for Virginia Prescott. It takes a certain kind of person to volunteer for active duty in a war zone, but what about those signing up to fight bygone battles of another era? What drives individuals to spend countless hours and dollars reenacting wars of the past, which have fixed outcomes? To find out, Word of Mouth producer Taylor Quimby spoke with Nick Kowalczyk, professor of writing at Ithaca College and war correspondent of sorts. He covered a reenactment of the Siege of Niagara, a battle from the French and Indian War, in a story for Salon.com called Embedded with the Reenactors. Taylor caught up with Nick at a Cornell University studio where he explained the importance of the trappings of history to a war reenactor.
Period dress has to be 100% authentic for a reenactor to be taken seriously by other reenactors. Other reenactors that get the bad nickname docu-Nazis, who are kind of considered the authenticity police, who kind of hawk and watch other reenactors, you know, based on the authenticity of their outfits. It's incredibly expensive. I mean, a shirt that looks like kind of bad pajamas today could cost a reenactor $75.
Okay, so what about guns or muskets? I mean, I assume that's a big part of it, too. Those replicas, are some people using actual antiques?
They're replicas, but they still cost, you know, $1,000, $2,000, perhaps even $3,000.
And I assume it has to work. I mean, they don't just sort of point guns at each other and say bang and fall down.
No, yeah, it has to work, and it has to be well cleaned. When I sort of embedded myself with a group of reenactors, the battle began, and I was standing next to one guy who he forgot to clean his gun before the reenactment started. And because his gun wouldn't work, he had to play dead. And at the same time, someone asked us, commanding general, are you guys dead? And we said, yes. And he said, can you be dead over there? Because we're moving in this direction.
So the two of you, corpses, got up.
We got up and moved.
Yeah. That reenactment that you took part in outside of Buffalo, New York, the Siege of Fort Niagara, a battle from the French and Indian War. You mentioned in your essay reenactors call it the F&I War.
And any reenactor who chooses a given time period really becomes obsessed with that time period. And it's really kind of its own subculture. I didn't know, for instance, that reenactors would call a basic coffee pot, you know, a boiler. But that's the same phrase that I heard being used again and again. Reenactors also share the word Farby, and this is across all reenacting time periods. Farby meaning, far be it for me to tell you that your buttons are inaccurate, but they are.
So you think one of the biggest motivating factors for the average reenactor is history. They're big history buffs.
Yeah, that's one of them, yeah. I mean, they're kind of addicted to history. Every reenactment period, they all share similar things. Like, they do it mostly for themselves and not for the public, despite what we may think, and they're happiest when the public isn't around. Hmm. It's kind of their way of participating in history, and the public's entertainment is just sort of a side thing.
Did you meet anybody or talk to anybody that was connecting history to modern politics or talking about, you know, the wars in Iraq or Afghanistan?
It's my sense that reenactors aren't asking those kinds of questions. They're here to celebrate America rather than to think about America. They're not liberal progressives. It's very much a white conservative hobby.
But you also sort of point out that a lot of reenactors are bringing their families. It's sort of a family event. What are they doing this whole time? Are they just lounging at a nearby hotel or?
No. So the men go off to battle and they do their drills. The women are relegated to staying back in the camp. They spend pretty much their entire day cooking, cleaning up after the meal, knitting. They can't read a book because that would be outside of the given time period. The children, when they're young, they're brought out onto the battlefield usually. Some of the older ones that I met, they actually keep dipping out every couple of hours to go off and smoke pot and then come back and they're stoned and participating on the battlefield.
Now you mentioned a couple times that, you know, there's a script that's being followed. Where does the script come from? Obviously history wrote the script, but who wrote the script?
The battles follow what happened in history for the most part. The Siege of Fort Niagara actually took about a month, and the event was condensed into 3 days. The way reenactments are organized is that there are companies that are by state and then battalions, and whoever is kind of the highest will be part of the people who decide how the event flows. And it really is a huge organizational process, you know, how the troops are going to move to avoid being seen by the public before they arrive in the battlefield, where the artists are going to be, where the settlers' camp is going to be. It takes a lot of planning.
And getting to the actual battle, I know there's a lot of lead up to the battle. You know, you talk about the camp, you talk about meeting various reenactors, and then you finally get to the battle. Can you give me a little bit about your initial impression? Can you sort of describe the atmosphere?
So to get to the battle, we had to walk first across a 4-lane divided highway and through some woods along like cliffs near Lake Ontario. And as we got closer, I kept hearing the crack of the muskets, saw smoke. We came out of the tree line, and I immediately saw a bunch of picnic tables and barbecue grills and some reenactors carrying the, you know, so-called wounded reenactors off of the battlefield. And we kind of advanced in a line. The men fired. Whenever anyone's gun stopped firing, they played dead. And then we just kind of kept advancing. A lot of the reenactors would shout huzzah whenever they fired their weapons. There was one particular reenactor. He looked at me because I was laying on the ground taking notes. And he asked me if I was scared. I said, no, I'm not. And he said, I didn't think you would be. And then the French fired another round at us. And he says, turns to me and says, that was a close one, Nick. And it wasn't an ironic statement. Like, he seemed to really be there.
Nick Kowalczyk there, professor of writing at Ithaca College and the brave journalist behind Embedded with the Reenactors. He was talking with Word of Mouth producer Taylor Quimby. You can find a link to Nick's story, as well as more about the Siege of Niagara, both real and reenacted, at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you missed any of the program or you want to pass a segment along to a friend, click over to wordofmouthradio.org, where you can listen to past shows, post questions or feedback about what you've heard on the air, and if you have a great word-of-mouthy idea, send it to us. We're listening. You can send us an email at wordofmouthradio.org, post on our Facebook page, or send us a tweet. I'm Brady Carlson. Join us again for more Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Virginia Prescott, and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction
from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's vice president of programming,
and web support from Brady Carlson
and Courtney Kenya.
Andrew Perella gives technical support,
and Dan Colgan. Dan the man runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individual,
not those of NHPR, its board of trustees, or its underwriters.
Really anybody else.
For information about the show, to listen to past segments, post a comment, or read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or use the On Demand tab on the NHPR app.
You can join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
And you can follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.